Animal Tales, bringing people and pets together to make it a better world for all of us. Here's Randy Graham.
And welcome back to Animal Tales. This is Randy Graham. And, you know, guys, starting this month, a new PBS documentary, 3 years in the making, will change the way America sees life on Earth. Scientists the world over now agree the Earth is experiencing runaway mass extinction of life across virtually all ecosystems. The film is called Hot Spots. And our guest this hour is producer and director Dr. Michael Tobias. He's the president of Dancing Star Foundation, a global ecologist with over 100 films, 35 books to his credit. The man doesn't sleep. Dr. Tobias, welcome to Animal Tales.
Randy, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
And in your intro, I don't even do you justice. I mean, your resume goes for miles. And you know I'm a big fan of yours, so can you give me a little bit background for our listeners about yourself and Dancing Star Foundation?
Well, the foundation's been in existence since the 90s. I've been the president since the late 90s. My own work is pretty much self-explanatory. Anybody can Google or Yahoo or whatever server they use to find out about people these days. But in a nutshell, I'm committed to alleviating suffering on the planet through whatever nonviolent and hopefully effective means I can embrace, and typically that means films and books and conferences. I'm an ecologist by training, did my PhD at the University of California in ecological anthropology, but also in nonviolence research. So I have really focused for the vast majority of my years on animal rights issues, global ecological issues, indigenous ethics and spirituality as it applies primarily to ecosystems, and ultimately what it's going to take, both through policy, through individual role model leadership, through subtle coercion,
right,
to get our species onto a higher level of compassion for all other sentient beings on this planet.
Boy, amen to that, because you know a lot about the work that I do, and compassion seems to be one of the big things that's lacking out there.
I think there is compassion hardwired into our species, and of course it's been a very robust debate in the anthropological and scientific communities, but I think there's no question that human beings have what it takes to be gentle, kind, and absolutely altruistic.
Yeah, even if it wasn't hardwired into us genetically, it can be taught.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Nature-nurture is almost an artificial divide, but I think it is hardwired, and we forget it, and it can easily be reminded. We can remember it just at the snap of our fingers or just with a single incident. I mean, every stray mutt that you feed on the streets in St. Louis and elsewhere, and every time you transform a person or see them transform from callousness and indifference to deep empathy, it's enlightening. And
yes,
we know how easy it can take place, but we also know that the crisis is enormous in terms of the indifference towards other species. And so as good as it can be, there's just more work than ever before us.
I agree. And you're right. Empathy, you know, even if that's something that needs to be taught, it can. And when especially the younger you are, I think, the easier it is to learn empathy. I just remember the first dog I ever rescued, I was 5 years old, and it was in Washington, D.C., in a snowstorm. And I remember looking in his eyes when I put him in front of the fireplace, and he was so thin. And I looked at him, and I could see the pain in his eyes. And I knew that if you asked me today, Randy, when did you first know that you had the capability of showing empathy? That was the day when I felt his pain. I mean, I did. I looked in his eyes as a five-year-old, felt his pain, and it changed my life.
You know? That's what happened. Yeah. I had a similar epiphany with a wolf when I was three.
Well, that's God, a wolf while you're three.
Yeah, a gray wolf and who was in the zoo, and I was taken there by my unwitting father on a Sunday morning, and there was this animal, desperate, pacing back and forth, you know, in the typical Striobates condition. And I looked right into this precious being's eyes, and it was a reciprocal trust that was made at that moment, and I've never gotten over it. Yeah, That's what happens, and it can happen at any age. I'm not surprised when I learn from friends that their 2-year-old child has volunteered to become, and adamantly so, a vegetarian.
I know.
Even though their parents may not be.
One of our best listeners, I mean, I love her to death. She's a kid, and we once did a vegetarian challenge because of her, challenging a lot of people to go vegetarian. It was really amazing. She got her aunt to do it, and quite a few people, and she was about 10 at the time. So
I'd like to see. You know, we've just heard the news, breaking news yesterday about Obama's pick for education secretary, who's among his many interesting ideas are gay-friendly high schools. I'd like to see vegetarian-friendly schools in this country.
You know, there should be that alternative on the lunch menu for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I know something got passed in New York for that, but I don't remember quite. It was a while back. But now I want to get to a little bit about 3 years in the making. I want to know what the catalyst was to start this project, you know, the film Hotspots, and why.
Well, okay. Hotspots refers to a methodology that was embraced by scientists around the world in 1987 after cumulative data poured in and suggested to Norman Myers at Oxford and many of his colleagues around the world that the original 16% of the terrestrial planet, which historically contained, from everything we can divine, the vast majority of life on Earth, the largest aggregates of flowering plants, of mammals and reptiles and amphibians and birds, existed thousands of years ago in about 16.2% of the planet. And you can pretty much guess that it was in the tropical equatorial belts where you had the densest rainforests, and the coral reefs right offshore, those rainforest countries. Today we're down to 2.3% remaining of that original habitat, and that 2.3% represents 35 terrestrial hotspots that have thus far been ascertained, primarily by the work of Conservation International in Washington and their partners around the world. And what they're saying with the hotspots theory and what we're saying in our film is that if the human species can manage to hold on to that 2.3% of remaining high biodiversity areas on Earth, we will in essence safeguard the future of evolution. It's a pretty weighty concept, but it's also a very accessible one because it allows us to recognize the logic that consolidated in these spectacular high abundant rarity areas, high biodiversity areas, are the largest numbers of species. And if we lose those, then we're going to lose basically the gene repositories for all the migratory creatures, for all of the seed banks that in fact transmigrate throughout the world. I mean, this is natural. And we're going to be in deep trouble. We're already in serious trouble to the extent that if you go with the higher numbers for projected species on Earth, which is somewhere in the 100 million realm.
Wow.
And you go by the Convention on Biological Diversity statements in May after their meeting in Bonn, and this past October after the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, had its 1-in-4-year meeting in Barcelona, there's no question that at the current trends of human destruction, we're going to lose more than half of all life on Earth. So that would be 50 million species. You do the math. We're talking about thousands of species potentially every day. Now, mind you, many of them are arthropods. Many of them are spiders and insects. Many are bacteria. Some are viruses. But they all count. Every single
Right. And everything, you know, serves a purpose on this world. So
absolutely. It's like that incredible eulogy that Amory Levins gave and was reported on by Tom Friedman at the end of his book, Flat, Hot, and Crowded, where he talks about my old colleague at Dartmouth, who passed away, Danoa Menos, who was responsible for looking at some of the really intense Club of Rome data and putting it together to suggest what the real drivers of environmental destruction were. And in the eulogy, Levins referred to a CEO who was trying to get some work done, and one of his children was bugging him, I guess, and so the anecdote goes. And so he took a big picture from the newspaper that he saw of the planet Earth, and he tore it into 100 little shreds, handed the pile in his palm to his kid, and said, "Here, go quietly sit down and see if you can't resurrect the map of the Earth." wow. thinking, okay, that's going to take a few days, and his child will be quiet. Well, guess what? 3 minutes later, the kid comes back with the completely resurrected planet Earth. And the father was astonished and said, how did you do that? And the kid proudly turns the now scotch-taped portrait of the Earth around, and there is the face of a human being.
Wow. That's...
Well, it was real simple. So this is a metaphor that's poignant, to be sure, and everyone gets it.
No, that's amazing. Hey, Dr. Tobias, I got to take a commercial break. But when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about, what looks like Earth's on its sixth mass extinction. I hope not, but also the economic crisis in Madagascar. Okay, so folks, hang in there. We'll be right back. You're listening to Animal Tales.
It's Randy Grimm with more on Animal Tales.
And welcome back to Animal Tales. This past hour, we've been talking with Dr. Michael Tobias. DancingStarFoundation.org is the website if you want to find out more information. But also, the film we're talking about is his film. It's called Hot Spots. It'll be airing on PBS this month and probably throughout the year. So you got to catch it. It's called Hot Spots. Now, before the break, Dr. Tobias, I read that this could be Earth's sixth mass extinction. And then I started thinking about what were the other five, but is that true?
Yeah, it is. There's no question about it. In the last approximately 500 million years, we've had five previous events, the most recent being about 65 million years ago, a gigantic meteorite smashed into the Earth, according to the best scientific consensual data, and it created a global winter for 2 years. It wiped out the dinosaurs, except for a few of the, thank God, remaining cetaceiforms, some of the macaws and so on.
Right.
Descended from the dinosaurs, of course. But we're in it now in a way that we've never seen before. The upwelling of methane gas from the oceanic depths didn't come close to the levels of attrition that we're seeing now. And in fact, it's so serious that if you consider that the natural background rate for extinctions is between 1 and 3 species every million years, we're losing between 1 and 2,000 species that are going to the brink of extinction or are threatened or endangered every day. So this is gigantic headline news. And what's also scary is that we're now not just talking about losing individual species. You know, we focus on the iconic panda bear, or there are certain Adelia penguins, or the Bengal tiger, Asian elephant.
Yeah, sometimes it seems like the cuter they are, the more important they seem to the media.
Mammals disappear fast, and it's just like with feral dog rescues and with dog injuries and human injuries, you get more notice when there's a little kitten trapped in a deli behind a brick wall in Manhattan than 800,000 people getting wiped out in an earthquake in China. I mean, there's something about the heartstrings which animals pull on people, but not enough to stop this massive extinction that we're experiencing.
Do you think it's because people sometimes feel helpless? Like,
sure.
What do I do?
Well,
I know that's me. I read through all the material for this interview, and I was like, when I put it down at the end, I was like, Randy, what? I don't know where to even begin to.
The Jains of India who tutored, if you will, Buddha and Mahatma Gandhi, and a long line of luminaries, all of whom have embraced vegetarianism and nonviolence for thousands of years, whether it's a Thoreau or a Percy Shelley or an Einstein or a Leonardo da Vinci or a Bernard Shaw, and the list goes on and on and on to people, of course, like yourself and Jane Goodall and Mark Beckhoff, Gene Bauer, Laurie Bowson, so many, Ingrid Newkirk, the list just keeps going. The people who are wonderful and doing great work have demonstrated that human beings have what it takes. Now, any child has what it takes. You described yourself as a 5-year-old rescuing a dog. You had what it takes, and you continue to demonstrate that with your virtuous good deeds. And this is fundamental to every major religious tradition, to every indigenous spiritual tradition, namely that human beings are a marvelous species. We have an infinite amount of compassion in our hearts. Nothing can stop us. We have courage, we have virtue, we have decency, we've invented Bach and chocolate chip cookies and Frisbees and dental floss, all the good stuff. And so this dark side, this daunting side, is not a function of individuals, it's a function of an unruly collective. And that has been pretty well demonstrated throughout time. I mean, just since the Renaissance, the human species, have slaughtered about 250 million of one another, 250 million people that we've killed since the time of the Renaissance.
Wow.
This is a lot of people. There's a lot of Holocaust going on. But when you look at what we're doing to other species, we realize that we're actually slaughtering hundreds of thousands of animals every minute. Every minute, if you take in fresh and marine vertebrates as well. So if we look at all of the carnage that's going on, I don't blame it on individuals, and I never recommend pointing fingers, because you have to point your finger at yourself if you do that. If you start that path, all of us are guilty. Everything we do involves some collaborative, unwitting act of violence.
Right.
And so it's not about blame. It's not about guilt. It's about what can we do to be better, to do better. And this is where I have great faith in the human species. Even as we do look out our windows and recognize that we're losing thousands of precious organisms every single day because of our behavior, we can still make a difference. For that spider that you rescue from the bathtub, for that ant that you don't step on.
I can't believe you're saying that, because I always think I'm the only person in the world that will not kill a bug. I mean, I won't.
Well, look, it was a great philosopher, Arnold Schopenhauer, who said, any fool child can step on a bug, but all the greatest scientists can't bring them back again.
That's true.
And I think at the heart of Jainism, which I referenced earlier, is this adamant belief that every creature has a right to exist, has a soul, has a spirit, as an identity, and as animal rights philosopher Tom Regan has said repeatedly, they have not just a biology, but a biography. And I'm referring to every bug on the planet, which is critical to life on Earth. I mean, the invertebrates in the jungle floor and living in the trees are what enable every other creature to thrive in the Amazon or anywhere else you choose to pick, whether the boreal forests or the southern convergence waters of the Antarctic. Every living creature is critical and fundamental to life on Earth, and we are just one humble species in that puzzle.
Right, and I think we should be the leader of the puzzle, of making sure the puzzle stays together.
Well, given our unwieldy impact, our ecological footprint, it's absolutely true. And there's an interesting analogy with all of the talk about how to combat global warming, which is just one of the subsets of the mass extinction that we're talking about. Buildings represent about a third of all emissions throughout the world. Buildings are, in a sense, a kind of human population that are consolidated. And what I was going to say earlier was the fact that we're not only losing millions of species, but we're also losing, on average, it now appears, something like 43,000 separate, discrete animal and plant populations every single day.
And it just blows me away.
Yeah, there's an estimated 2.3 billion populations left on Earth. That's an ant pile. That's a flock of birds. That's a pack of wild dogs in Africa, or a pride of lions, or a pod of dolphins. Those are discrete populations. We're losing 43,000 of them every day.
And you think
so
that the
we've got to work. We've got lots to do.
Well, do you think the economic crisis has a connection with our ecological crisis?
Well, it's a mirror. It's a mirror image of what we're doing to the planet. I mean, it's Gaia, Mother Earth, telling us, "Hey, guys, look in the mirror. This is the impoverishment of the Earth that you yourselves are now beginning to experience." It is a tragic wake-up call that one hopes will resonate at levels which transform misery into a willingness to listen and an absolute conviction to do differently tomorrow, so that life will prosper, so that we'll give back to the Earth rather than just taking. What scares me, of course, is that when gas prices plummet, people, and I've seen these headlines, say we no longer need to focus on alternative energy solutions.
Right.
Better, we can drive more miles this weekend. mean, this is all the wrong signals.
Well, look at the bright side, though, that the oil companies, as soon as they see people get like that, they immediately crank, cut back on production, so the prices go back up.
Well, I think what the oil companies, what the multinationals are recognizing smartly, self-interestedly as business entities, but nonetheless smartly, is that their portfolios have had to expand. So BP now likes to liken itself to Beyond Petroleum. Shell now has, for years, had a hydrogen division. Almost every major oil company is looking at alternative energy because they know that if they're going to stay in business, they're going to have to be energy providers, not oil providers.
That's true. And I do think that at least in the United States, a lot of people are waking up to this and waking up to, having a car that gets better gas mileage, not just for economical reasons, but for pollution and stuff like that. So I do think people are more aware than ever.
I agree, but I do feel very bewildered at times when I discern that the environmental movement has not yet embraced compassion.
No, you're right.
That conservation circles in general are not yet talking about nonviolence in the individual. They're talking about populations. And one of the major focuses of our foundation, Dancing Star, and of the work that my closest colleague and wife, Jane Morrison, and I are really looking at, and all our colleagues at the foundation and around the world, the partners we work with in many, many countries, many of whom you see in our new book, Sanctuary, Global Oases of Innocence, which came out at the Smithsonian this summer. What we're trying to do is reconcile animal rights and conservation biology so that scientists who are involved in the natural sciences are not simply talking about these kind of distant theoretical populations living in the high canopies. They're talking about the individuals. They're focusing on the lives of precious individuals. And once we can get that message delivered clearly and firmly, I think we're going to see a major transformation. One of the things we're doing toward that end, for example, I've been the chief advisor to the government of Bhutan in the Eastern Himalayas during the writing of their what's called Biodiversity Action Plan, as stipulated under their signatory obligations with the UN Convention on Biological Diversity. That was one of the outstanding results of the Rio Summit back in the early 90s in Brazil. And almost every country in the world other than the United States has signed and ratified the Convention on Biological Diversity. Well, we're writing actively animal rights into this UN statutory document, which is going to have ripple effects, we hope, throughout the rest of the world and may be the first animal rights text within a UN document. We're just finishing that now.
And I do have high hopes with the new administration to be a little more open-minded about animal rights and not just animal rights, but just, I call it animal decency. You know.
A very nice phrase. Yeah. No, I'm impressed with the choice of Chew, and I think Salazar of Colorado, who since the 1500s his family grew up in a valley in New Mexico, has definitely a decent pro-conservation, pro-environmentalist leaning from everything I know about him. I think that the EPA choice and the whole tenor of an administration, Obama's, which is looking to science as opposed to looking away from science,
right,
is a really major overhaul of what has been a bankrupt system, a system in total denial, a system that has been completely callous to those who would take great umbrage at vice presidents going out and shooting, and presidents thinking nothing of
Well, the vice president ended up shooting some guy in the head. He mistaken it as a bird, didn't he?
Of course, but just the whole hunting syndrome, which we saw recently again, in raising its head with that ghastly, murky.
You know, Michael, I read a story in the paper about I think it was Post-Dispatch where they're using hunting as rehabilitation for Iraqi vets, and I didn't see how that was being rehabilitated. It was an uplift. It was supposed to be an uplifting story, but I guess someone like me saw it as kind of odd and, you know, not really that uplifting.
Yeah, I think anyone who comes from an animal decency, as you call it, orientation, is probably looking at most things that come out of American culture and European culture and G20 culture as a bit odd. Because let's face it, the vast majority of members of the human club don't yet get it.
Mm-mm.
Don't yet.
And I don't see how that's therapeutic. From you go from shooting people to shooting animals as therapeutic. I think, you know, for the love of God, get an Xbox 360 and play a game, you know, or something. But I just don't get that. I didn't see the therapy behind it. I only got about a minute here before we have to take a commercial break. So when we come back, because I know we don't have that much time with you, though I could talk to you all night long. I want to know a little bit more about Madagascar that's in the film Hot Spots, and of course the black lemur, and then also I was really curious about that southern bamboo rat because I found that interesting too. Guys, hang in there. We're going to go to a commercial break. When we come back, we'll have more of, I mean, to me, one of the most amazing men on the planet, Dr. Michael Tobias. We'll be right back. You're listening to Animal Tales.
As much as you do. It's Animal Tales with Randy Graham.
And welcome back to Animal Tales. This is Randy Graham, and this past hour I've been talking with the amazing Dr. Michael Tobias. And check out the website. It's dancingstarfoundation.org, folks. It's dancingstarfoundation.org. He's done over 100 films and 35 books, and his new film is called Hot Spots. It's airing on PBS. It's a documentary. It's airing this month, but it's going to be airing, I'm sure, many months to come. You got to check it out and catch it. I got to ask you about the movie Hot Spots.
Sure.
What places do you go to? And you know me, I love Madagascar. I told you during one of the commercial breaks, I anything with Madagascar, I'm glued on like Discovery Channel, whatever. And I'm dying to know the story behind the blue-eyed black lemur.
Well, we chose representative locations. We couldn't obviously encompass them all in a two-hour movie. And just for your listeners, some of the PBS stations are airing it 1 hour one night, and then like a week later, 1 hour. And some are airing it the whole 2 hours at once. But if you only see the first hour, make sure you find out when they're going to air the second half.
And hopefully it'll come out on DVD, I hope.
It is, you can get it right now on DVD. If you go to our website and look under products at dancingstarfoundation.org, you can order Hotspot.
Oh, guys, there's your holiday shopping right there. Go to dancingstarfoundation.org and get the film Hotspots.
It's a pretty elegant and upbeat film. And Russell Mittermeier, who is the host and the president of Conservation International and truly one of the foremost conservationists and herpetologists, you know, reptiles and amphibian expert and primatologists on the planet. He's sort of David Attenborough meets Harrison Ford meets someone yet new that you've never seen before. We started on Easter Island to look at sort of the worst case scenario, but also to acknowledge that the Rapa Nuians are themselves, all 3,000 or so of them who live out on Easter Island, trying to reforest and bring back the native species. We then head to CI's headquarters in Washington. To look at some of the satellite data, which then leads us to Madagascar, which is the largest, almost half-hour portion of the movie, where we were fortunate to be able to work with the Guide Association of Ondasi Bay. These are indigenous peoples who've grown up in the forest, who've learned the language of natural history, who know all their species, and now are taking ecotourists there to see rare creatures like the Indri, the largest of the living lemurs. We then flew up in a chartered Russian little funky plane to a northwestern remote corner of Madagascar, where we went in with a research team and documented possibly a new pygmy lemur that has never been seen.
Oh,
but
cool.
But also the blue-eyed black lemur, or Sclater's lemur, as it's called, after the scientist Sclater. And they do indeed have blue eyes. They're absolutely gentle. There's no male dominance, as you see in so many primate groups like baboons.
Or humans, but go ahead.
And of course. but in fact, they hang out together. They love each other. We then filmed in all over Brazil. We were with the northern muriqui, another primate icon. It's the largest primate in the Western Hemisphere. We were very fortunate in southeastern Peru in the tropical Andes, where we were filming with citizens with a variety of parrots, parrotlets, and macaws, to be the first ever to film at about 12:30 at night the southern bamboo rat, which is endemic to the southeastern Peruvian and Bolivian forests of the Amazon basin. It's a rodent that's trying to be a primate, and you almost see it in the film.
Yeah, he's growing hands, right?
It does. It's quite an extraordinary, beautiful creature. It peed at the camera. I guess that's its way of saying hello.
No, he sounds like me.
I mean, it was quite a gorgeous minute, which is all we had to capture it on film.
After that, you go to New Zealand, right?
Well, New Zealand and Southern California. It's a big hotspot in the film.
And the film has a lot to do about hope, correct?
That's right. Even though we've referenced the fact that we are in a massive extinction era that's going to last for thousands of years and could, if we don't do something drastically, result in something like 96% of all life on Earth disappearing. We are seeing in the film hotspots reasons to be very optimistic. People around the world are making a difference. The film rallies to the cause of human intervention to save the rarest species on Earth. But by implication, what it really says is that it's not just the rare giant pandas or penguins, but it's every feral dog, it's every stray cat, it's every little bug that needs our help. And we have the power, the capacity, the know-how, the willingness, and the resolve to do it. So this is really a celebration of the human spirit working to save other species.
Awesome. And it's dancingstarfoundation.org, folks. And Dr. Tobias, thank you so much.
Randy, thanks for having me.
I got to have you back, buddy, because I have a million more questions for you, but we're out of time.
Well, thanks for all the great work that you and your colleagues are doing.
Oh, you're welcome. And I'll talk to you soon. And okay. I'll be getting my DVD from Dancing Star Foundation, so I can't wait to watch.
Have a great holiday, Randy.
Okay, you too. And hey, guys, hang in there. We'll be right back. We're going to commercial.